go to the United Nations and see if a resolution was adopted that said, no, the world has faced the Nazi Holocaust. We know the power of this dehumanization, of this destruction of human life, and the human family will not sit by and allow this kind of destruction to go on. There's not a single resolution adopted at the United Nations about Cambodia. They were too busy. They spent 40% of their time at the last session of the United Nations adopting resolutions on the obscenity that Zionism is racist. Who has time to adopt resolutions about Cambodia, about Vietnamese boat people, about Malaysians, about ethnic Chinese? Who has time even to adopt resolutions about Uganda, where Idi Amin, that great president for life, destroyed, not Jews, nearly 500,000 black Christians were destroyed over the past 8 years. Who cares? What's the value of human life? The United Nations, last hope mankind. Go see if the resolution was adopted. In fact, when Idi Amin came to the United Nations, he, like Yasser Arafat, that other great moral hero, was invited as a conquering hero to come before the United Nations and to stand before 157 nations to receive a standing ovation. And he was such a great moral figure there, this great hero of the 20th century, he would not deign to read his own speech. He had a second-in-command read the text of his speech to these peasants of the world. He is now, not incidentally, lolling around on the beaches of Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, that other great democratic country of great human freedom and liberty. And when he's not there, he commutes to Libya's Gaddafi, who provides for him. My friends, I have no interest in trying to create atrocity stories. God knows, as one looks around the world today, I haven't mentioned Iran, where every day dozens and dozens of children are massacred, all in the name of Allah. Ayatollah Khomeini and his minions, Lebanon, 50,000 Muslims and Christians have been destroyed. Who marches for Lebanon? Ireland, never mind, okay, colored people, black people, maybe that's a different world. Ireland, day in and day out, Catholics killing Protestants, Protestants killing Catholics. Finally now, after 12 years of that struggle where thousands of Christian people have been slaughtered, finally this year, people are beginning to march in New York City saying, stop it. Stop killing black people, our fathers and mothers, our brothers. That's the price one pays when one believes that one can be a spectator to the events of history, when one goes on to say that these are no concern to me, when one ultimately says this Nazi thing is some kind of aberration in human history. It's a Jewish obsession, some even say a Jewish trick. If the world continues to follow that course, it will prepare itself for Ugandans, God forbid, and Iran, and Cambodians all over the world. If there is no sense among the world's leaders that there is deemed to die on, that there is an accountability, that the world will not allow human lives to be snuffed out as if they were candlelights, that there are consequences for the way one behaves with human societies, that's what Jews are trying to say every year when Yom HaShoah. We stake our existence, Jews and Christians, on the fundamental biblical affirmation that every human life is created with Tzelem Elohim. Every human life is created in the sacred image of divinity itself. Every human life is of infinite worth and preciousness. Every life is of ultimate value, that no human life is expendable. That no human being has the right to use another human being for one's program or project or revolution or ideology. That every life is an end in itself. That's what the title bound and the gazelles of the world testify to when they light those six candles. We refuse to be snuffed out in the darkness of the world that allows Cambodias and Ugandas to go on. And we affirm that we will hold that light of the value of life alive until somewhere that light will illuminate the flickering darknesses of the world. I want to tell you one more story. I call it a midrash, a modern parable of our contemporary world that has to do with the theme of pluralism in the world. In December 1978, some 10 months after our first mission to Southeast Asia, well, not incidentally, when we returned, we came back with a series of 14 recommendations, which we gave to President Carter and then to Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, Brzezinski of blessed memory, and the heads of both houses of Congress. The first recommendation we made to the President of the United States, not incidentally growing out of discussion in our Citizens Commission, of a Nazi experience, of a determination not to be the spectators again when human lives are at stake. We came to the President of the United States and said, Mr. President, there's something wrong when we see shiploads of people drowning all over the South China Sea before our eyes, and we come to the Philippines and Manila and see the Sixth Fleet steaming there, doing nothing but polishing the brass. Sign of the presence of the United States, very important. But for all of those ships and battleships and frigates to be standing there idly, not moving, while literally several hundred thousand people have already drowned before the eyes of the world, Mr. President, we make official request of you, of this delegation, that you move this week to move the Sixth Fleet into the South China Sea with instructions that no one is to be allowed to be drowned in the sea. And if the boat gets in trouble, to help them with supplies to enable them to move on. For Jimmy Carter, much has been said about him as negative and critical. But I want to tell you, it was his Christian compassion and his humanism and his commitment to human rights. Above all, his deep biblical sense about the value of human life that led him instantaneously to say to our group, my God, you're absolutely right. I don't know why we haven't thought of that earlier. He called in one of the aides from the White House and dictated a memorandum, an executive order to the Sixth Fleet. Within the week, you are to move into the South China Sea with instructions that no ship is to be allowed to be drowned. And if any ship is in difficulty, if you see people hungry, you're to give them water and food and help them find haven. The drowning of the Vietnamese boat people, the Laotians and ethnic Chinese, virtually came to an end after that year. There are several hundred thousand people living today because a group of Christians and Jews who take their values and their ideals seriously and cared and moved to make sure that they became part of the reality of the foreign policy of this nation. And after America did it, suddenly it became compassion chic. And then Italy sent in a boat filled with pieces. And Liberia sent in a boat. France sent in a boat. And suddenly everybody wanted to get in on the act of saving human lives. It became the thing to do. Incredible how public psychology works. Second story I want to tell you, and I want to close with this. In December of 78, we sent back a delegation of the International Rescue Committee to Southeast Asia, because by that time, not only 8 or 10,000 people were leaving, 50, 60,000 people were being driven out of Vietnam. They were being robbed by the government. Mothers, grandmothers, children were being raped, abused, pirates stole everything from them on the street. On this particular Sunday, I was going up the coast alone as private mission with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, a young Swede by the name of Hansen. We came up to the northeast province of Malaysia called Terengganu Province. It is the most conservative of the provinces in Malaysia. Malaysia, incidentally, is a country that is about 60% Muslim, 40% ethnic Chinese. constant rivalries between them, the ethnic Chinese in Malaysia, as in other parts of Southeast Asia, are called the Jews of Southeast Asia. They're all professional people. They're involved in business. They're involved in professional life. So there's that kind of rivalry and resentment. Ethnic Chinese foreigners who come to our country and do well, better than we do. And on this Sunday, on the corner of Trengganu province, as I came up to the very edge of it with Hansen, the UNHCR person, High Commissioner for Refugees person, across the bay, South China Sea, opposite Trengganu province was an island called Pulau Bidang. It was such a beautiful island 3 months before, with palm trees and eucalyptus trees, that months before they had filmed some scenes for Hollywood movies for the South Pacific. Idyllic place, paradise. James Michener, South Pacific imagery. Now that island was filled with 60,000 people. Four toilets for the whole island. Six wells. On this particular Sunday morning, as we were standing there, we saw a boat coming around the edge of Pulau Bidang. Pulau Bidang was too occupied, no room for anyone to land. Safety hazard now. And as this boatload of people came by, some 250, Hansen estimated, majority of them ethnic Chinese, but a good number of Vietnamese, this boat also battered. Could hear the motor skipping on its last legs as it came in, moving in to land, to beach in Trengganu province. Trengganu province, the most conservative, fundamentalist of the Muslim communities in Malaysia. As that boat came in and began to land, to beach on Trengganu province, suddenly, turmoil, havoc. A whole village of Muslims came down, descended on the edge of the beach, sticks, rocks, spears, screaming, as Hansen was to translate for me. They are screaming, infidels, heretics, pork eaters. The Chinese eat pork, the Muslims do not eat pork. Any reason, any imagery. And as that boat was about to land, they moved in, this village of ultra-conservative fundamentalist Muslims pushed the boat out into the sea until it hit a reef and cracked open. And I turned to Hansen and I said, my God, what's going on here? I grabbed his hand, pulled him in, and we ran together, began pulling people out of the water. I saw an elderly Chinese woman, probably about 80 years old. I had seen her face as they were coming in. I looked at her because she reminded me of my mother's face, broad face, white hair, as if I was seeing my mother coming in on that boat, landing in that haven. Her face was filled with hope as they came around the bend of Pulau Bidang, and I saw as she hit the shore and these Muslim fanatics descended on her, and on that ship, her face turned to horror. She started to tear. You could see death on her face. Boat broke up. We ran in and we began pulling people out of the water onto the shore, pushing back the Muslims and putting the people on the shore. And we pulled out 15, 18 people. Children, babies. All the rest drowned for us. I came away from that experience traumatized. I could not sleep for nights after that. And all I could conjure with is that these were people who believed that they were doing the will of God in destroying other humans. This was the foretaste of Ayatollah Khomeini and the notion that he, in his infallibility, has a monopoly on the salvation of humankind. And that the only way to be saved is his way to be saved. And I began to see over and again, as I've seen now in the Middle East all over, the greatest deficiency that exists in the human condition today is the absence of that which we take absolutely for granted in the United States of America. Namely, that there is no notion of religious, racial, ethnic pluralism. There is no conception in the Muslim world and in other parts of the world, especially among fundamentalists, that it is at the heart of highest religious faith and humanism that there is an obligation not only to live and let live, but live and help. The world is divided, and this apocalyptic vision of that fundamentalist world as a conflict between the children of light and the children of darkness, and they seeing themselves as the pure children of light, have a right from God to destroy the children of darkness. The world is divided between angels and devils, and they have a right to declare who the devils are and to destroy the devils. Satan must be destroyed for utopia to come. They have no monopoly on that vision, incidentally. There are Christians who have that same vision, that they have a monopoly on salvation, who have no notion of religious pluralism. There are some fundamentalists in America who believe the only way to save America is to make America into their kind of evangelical Christian America. They call on people to vote only for born-again Christians, who have somehow some automatic built-in radar that enables them to be purely moral. Would that it were so. Jenrette was a born-again Christian. The president of the American Conservative Caucus, who liked to preach to the nation about his fallen morality before he was caught in a bathroom in a Capitol building pandering homosexual acts with a 16-year-old boy, preached about saving America his way. Congressman Kelly in Florida was a born-again Christian. He was going to tell the rest of Americans in their debauchery how he was going to save the country. And then they found his hand in $25,000 of an abscam till. But they believe that the world is divided between the children of light and the children of darkness, and Jews are not exempt from that. Ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel play that same game. Not so much with Christians, but with other Jews. Conservative Reform Jews somehow are part of a league of Satan. We've got to be contained. In the United States of America, we take for granted to our peril the fact that during the course of the past 100 years, this nation has been the laboratory in which religious, racial, ethnic pluralism has moved from being a theory in the mind of some of our best minds in American history to becoming an actual daily reality. If you travel through the United States of America, the greatest thing that I regard as the greatest achievement of 30 years of work is that in every city in the United States today, as in this city tonight, there are literally hundreds upon hundreds of Christians and Jews who come together in mutual respect, in mutual appreciation, faithful to their own commitments, and having the generous capacity to respect the light of truth and value which every other religious community upholds, who come to the dialogue table not to deny or undermine the other, but in fact to affirm and confirm the other in the fullness, as Martin Buber used to declare, in the fullness of their selfhood, as they are in their own terms. That experience of religious, racial, ethnic pluralism is the core idea of American democracy. The principle of separation of church and state rests on that reality. Freedom of conscience rests on that reality. And the whole vitality of this voluntary pluralist society is one of the great achievements in human social history. I want to suggest to you that more important than computer technology, which we export to the world, including the Soviet Union, more important than creating colonial empires all over the world, China, Russia, elsewhere, the most important contributions that America has to give to the human family today is the experience, the living reality of what is happening in this room. Jews, Catholics, Protestants, Evangelical Christians, Greek Orthodox, Black Churchmen, Hispanics, people who come together as first-class citizens, faithful to their own traditions, in their full power and their full depth, with having the capacity to relate to one another in love and caring and compassion, joining hands together to deal with the great human problems of world refugees and world hunger and domestic justice issues. That's a very powerful reality we have created in this society. And now that we are able to come together to deal with the most painful, ultimate issues of the value of human life and the trauma which sought to undermine, debase that in the Nazi Holocaust, we are beginning to move together into the central realization that unless we move from seeing the Holocaust as some Jewish obsession hang-up, to realize together how much we have at stake in upholding the value of human life, of every human being that inhabits this planet, that it is no longer permissible in the kind of world in which we live today, a world in which there is the possibility of instant global annihilation through nuclear proliferation. Arms all over the world, like lollipops do, going all over the world. The capacity for universal destruction. In this kind of world, it is no longer a luxury to stand by and say, someday I'll think about that Holocaust. The time for learning the lesson of the Holocaust is now. The time for learning the meaning of standing against evil and demonism is now. While there is still time to stand against those forces of nuclear proliferation, and I'm interested in a strong defense, the kind of madness that is now taking place in a world in which there is the capacity, if we do not create another single ICBM, we now have the capacity to create 640,000 Hiroshimas. And not another bomb is happening. We now have the capacity to destroy the world 12 times over. If you care about the value of human life, if you want to see the implications of learning from the Nazi experience for the survival of human families, do not only what we're doing here this day, but make sure that this becomes a course of learning and life for every American who has some conscience left, and to whom the conception of the dignity of human life is more than an empty phrase recited only on Saturdays and Sundays in church and synagogues. The survival of the human family depends on learning that lesson now.
Rabbi, it is impossible for me to express to you the deep appreciation that we all feel to you personally for this deep, reaching, soul-searching, and sobering address. On two previous occasions, I had the special privilege of being the responder to an address, to addresses given by Mark. I always found that difficult, because what does one say in response to this kind of presentation? Tonight, my task is much easier. I'm only the moderator, and it is up to you to give the response, with questions or comments. It's not easy, I know, for you. We all feel as though we ought to have some time to reflect on what was said. But we're living in a world where we do not always have the privilege of taking as much time as we feel we need, and that's the case now also. Let's therefore begin with such questions as some of you may have, and while others take a little more time to phrase their own. Let's have the first question.
Tell me your name.
$1 million was not raised because Federico Brew was not seriously interested in $1 million. He began talking after there was some indication from the JDC and Hayas people that they had in fact tabled back asking the money be raised. They asked for another 24 hours. They said, if you give us 48 hours, we will try to raise all that money. Brew said, well, if that's the case, then maybe we should be talking about $2 million. It's a cynical, ruthless exploitation of the situation, and it conceivably could have gone on indefinitely. And when is that altogether clear, whether it was really a trade-off for money itself or whether it was something ideological at work there? But in point of fact, he was not responsive to any constructive resolution. And when they asked for an extension of time, he absolutely refused it, which really meant that he was not serious in getting it. And there may very well have been many other factors at work. The JDC and Hayas people, to their credit, and the record will show this, literally went sleepless, worked heaven and earth, reached everybody they conceivably could to try to stop that from happening. And they were dealing with another kind of totalitarian mentality that really didn't give a damn about the value of life and were using human beings as checker pieces of earth on their board for either money or other reasons. It is a very dismal chapter. Yes, ma'am. Tell me.
In medium medicine, the survivor wrote together. I was standing after this horrible thing happened. Everything was dirty. And I told myself, where are the American troops? What happened to this America? To our brothers and sisters, and I don't know the answer.
I'm not sure we know all the answers. There is an important book called Why Six Million Die by Arthur Morris, which has some of the information. I was a much younger person at the time of the very great tragedy of the Nazi Holocaust. I remember as a child going to rallies, black books in the Jews of Poland, rallies trying to stir the conscience of the American people in behalf of the Jews in Poland and Europe generally. There's chapter and verse on the interventions made by very great men of the caliber of Stephen Wise and Abihail Silver and many others. I don't believe American Jewish leadership has any leadership, including Jewish leadership in the camps themselves, who went through that kind of self-examination, are exempt from accountability. The accountability is not for the purpose of destroying somebody, but for the purpose of learning from that lesson for the future. But if one has to find some explanation of what did not happen and why it did not happen, I would suggest to you that the answer is to be looked for far more in the records of that great American president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and even more precisely the records of what went on in the State Department with people like Breckinridge Long and Cordell Hull and others. There is a lineal relationship between the anti-Semitic elements in the State Department and the Arabists today, who are seeking to move the United States massively away from support of Israel, who want to make Israel expendable for the foreign policy of the United States in the Middle East, and now to make Saudi Arabia some kind of putative democracy, this feudal monarchy, where women have their heads cut off for minor violations is now to be made the heroic foundations of America's foreign policy. There is evil in the world, and there are evil people, and there are anti-Semitic people in the highest levels of government. And we will do ourselves a very great disservice if we end up with a kind of Zelstas of looking for Jews as the scapegoats for what went wrong when Jewish leaders were powerless other than to beg, cajole, pressure. The life and death decisions rested in the hands of the people who had the power to open the gates of Palestine. The life and death decisions rested in the hands of the British Air Force and the American Air Force, which had the capacity to destroy the railroads to Auschwitz and Mechelen. Now, Arthur Goldberg has just organized a committee to look into these questions. Not in the sense of kind of self-flagellation, because we will do ourselves a very great disservice. We can bring about a kind of paralysis and guilt, useless guilt. But to look at the question with a view toward learning from the past so that today we can learn what went wrong. Today we can learn the lesson of the psalmist, Al-Tiftahu, that if you need to then a dumb shame of Shua, trust not in princes and the Son of Man, for in them there is no salvation. Not to give ultimate loyalty to any politician or any head of the White House or anywhere else. Because you see what happened. Ronald Reagan, before the election, made the best speeches on Israel and the PLO. And now he's about to hand over the whole Middle East to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. So it's a matter of having some proportion, and it's painful. Because one would like some clean resolution, some simple answer. And I'm afraid the answer is not clean and it's not simple. It doesn't give one great comfort. But at the very least, we owe it to ourselves not to give Hitler the final victory by turning on ourselves and making ourselves the victims. We were the victims of victimization by others, not by our own.
Yes.
Well, what did you know about Raoul Wallenberg? I've read a lot about him. I still have a lot of questions, and I'll take you two questions. What exactly led to his arrest in 1945 by the Russians? How come we didn't hear about him until recently? And suddenly with an upset in interest in Raoul Wallenberg. And do you think that he is still alive in Russia or not?
You want all of that on 1 foot in 30 seconds. When do you serve breakfast? But that's a partial affiatsmo. That's a very large chapter, and one cannot do justice in a brief time. I would suggest you read the newly published book, The Righteous Gentile, about these questions on Raoul Wallenberg. Without getting into far too great detail, Wallenberg was a heroic personality during the Hungarian captivity, who used his role as a Swedish ambassador in Hungary to provide visas. And during those last months of 44 and 45, when the Nazis decided in their utter vengeance to wipe out as many Jews in Hungary as they could, some 450,000 were destroyed. Wallenberg helped save tens of thousands by providing them with visas for escape to the borders of Hungary. The reason that it is an issue is that some people who have come back from the Soviet Union claim that they have seen Wallenberg in prison and that he's alive. The Soviet Union arrested him at the end of the war on the grounds that he was an agent of the CIA. He was charged with being an American spy, as well as a spy for West European governments. The Soviet Union claimed that he died of a heart attack in prison. And that's why there was not much activity for a period of time. People simply accepted the fact that he was reported dead, and records were made available by the Soviet Union, false records apparently, substantiating ostensibly his death. Since persons have come back from Soviet Union who've been to the prisons and have seen someone who they think is Wallenberg, that has led to a whole rekindling of interest in the Wallenberg issue. And the rest you know. I mean, an honorary citizen of the United States, that's some great comfort to a man in a Soviet prison.
So it's a nice gesture. It had political purposes in Washington at the time when they were preparing to sell AWACS, a gesture to the Jews about Wallenberg. Nobody was fooled by that, at least in our leadership was not fooled by that. I thought it was a nice gesture, but there's no substitute for AWACS. In any case, I would suggest you read the literature, and there are Wallenberg committees, I'm sure, here in the city. There certainly is a large national one in New York, and if you're interested in becoming involved, I would encourage you to become involved in activity to keep alive the memory of this person, even if we're not living today. He's one of the Hasidei Umot HaOlam, one of the righteous Gentiles of the world. He deserves all honor and glory from the Jewish people. Yes, sir.
My name is Jack Michel. First, I'd like to thank you for inviting us here today and have an eloquent presentation on the meaning of the Holocaust yesterday, and I agree in my professional career.
Thank you.
My question is this: how do you account for the this revisionist historic stenography which is appearing, one, at this time, and how should the Jewish community react to it?
Again, it's a rather large and complicated issue when one doesn't do justice to the brief reply, but that's the way I have to deal with it. Motivations for the revisionist history, as I see it, are complex and multi-level. They come from many sources. On one level, and we know this for reality, I'm in charge of a program we have in re-education of Germans about democracy. In the German school system. We, in fact, going to Germany, my fiance, in December for a conference of German educators where we're publishing a whole series of textbooks with the German Department of Politische Bildung and University of Duisburg. Professor Schatz was present at one of our earlier conferences. We have a major conference in December now at Arnoldstein. And as I meet with German scholars, a number of them who really are Bali Tshuva, who really have deep anguish over what has happened in their country. Many of them have put us in touch with sources. There is a substantial body of Nazis alive and well in Nazi Germany. In Dusseldorf, there is a chapter of the SS troops who meet every month as if they were Kiwanis, or the Lions, or the Rotary Club. And they publish a monthly newsletter. Social happenings among stormtroopers, children. Son and daughter of this stormtrooper is getting married to the son, to the daughter, etc. They're having a picnic. The Nazis are determined to try to revise that history. And they are a significant force in collusion with the Nazis in the United States. They have direct linkage with a small group of American neo-Nazis in Lincoln, Nebraska, who ironically are publishing some of the major Nazi literature and are exporting it to Germany, which has been translated. They're in league with Nazis in the whole of Latin America, the Nazi nests in Argentina and throughout Mexico and elsewhere. That's one of the new ecumenical undergrounds. Part of their intention is to try to relieve themselves of the burden of responsibility for the barbarous acts they carried out against Jews and humanity. They want to try to clean up their act, as it were, before they're through. My own sense is that the Soviet Union, in its own devious ways, is not without some responsibility for what is happening here as well. You see, the last shred of moral claim that the State of Israel has on the conscience of Western Christendom is the Nazi Holocaust. This happened in your heartland, in the heart, at the heartbeat of Western Christian civilization. And the Christians, many of the Christians who respond, Franklin Littell, who lived in Germany at the end of World War II, the Christians who saw what was happening to Christendom, who wanted to face this. Germans, including many German Catholics and Protestants, who acknowledged that somehow they cannot rest in peace and conscience as Christians unless they make some moral reparation to the Jewish people, and they see support of Israel as that focus of moral reparation. That's why you have a column called Nesamim, of Christians from many parts of the world who have come there to live with Jews to stand in solidarity with them to say, in atonement for what we have done in the past, not only during the Nazi experience, but for 2,000 years of Christian teaching of contempt, we want to identify ourselves in fate and destiny with you. That's why you have the Marienschwester, the German sisters who have come to live in Israel, to do nothing but be there for healing purposes, as a sign of confession, of if not guilt, at least responsibility for the future. And so those forces which are determined to try to undermine Israel's moral position in the world have joined together, first to deny the Nazi Holocaust ever happened, to deny that 6 million Jews ever died, there was an epidemic. They're now saying it was like typhus, it helped clean up the typhus problem. And there are a few hundred thousand Jews, and the crematoria were places for purifying people like disease. Which sad. The rage that this sits. That people would have the obscene minds to utter such words. But the intention is to undermine the moral foundations of any current support for Israel. And PLO people, and PLFP people, and you can see Muslim literature. Harkabi has collected tons of Muslim literature in the Arab world, doing exactly that. Joined together with Nazis and some left-wing forces out of Ukraine, the Kiev Institute for anti-Semitism. All of that is to create a new history so that the old history will lose its power to call forth for responses in solidarity with Jews. And a way to deal with that, apart from exposing it, is what happened in California 2 weeks ago. The Journal of Historic Review of so-called scholars was sued for $1.25 million. And the Supreme Court awarded that claim to the survivor, the Jewish survivor, who sued that journal. It's essential to continue. One of the reasons I became involved in serving as a consultant to NBC on the Holocaust was because the Jews were saying to me, my dear friend Elie Wiesel was saying, you can't deal with it, it's soap opera. And I said to him one day, Elie, with all respect, you've been writing and lecturing now for decades, but I tell you, from what I see around America, 85% of the American people don't know, don't care, couldn't care less. Know almost nothing about it. If we, through the NBC Holocaust, can reach Americans, touch their conscience by that kind of story, at least to have them to understand what began to happen. Don't think that'll be a mitzvah gedolah, a very great commandment. We reached 150 million people in the United States. Elie Wiesel and 100 Elie Wiesel would have to lecture for 2 lifetimes to reach that many people for the beginning of that kind of story. It was also an effort to stand against the revisionist historians. On November 17th, you will see Skokie on CBS. I urge you to watch it. I've just seen a preview of it. It is a very powerful moving film with extraordinary performance by Danny Kaye as the survivor. And by the time Danny Kaye finishes with his wife and daughter telling that story, I assure you that those millions of Christians hopefully will see that, will understand why the Jews cannot forget nor forgive. So that is the kind of counterforce that is required on every level of American communications.
Yes, we take over.
Well, you take one more. I hear from a lady over here. What's your name? That's part of the same kind of Prussian mentality that deals with a human community as if it were some kind of political abstraction
which can be manipulated for one's own purposes without any claim on human compassion. My group, the American Jewish Committee, has a dialogue going with